Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, where Jill Margo makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here quite a few years ago on the occasion of the first book she wrote on Frank Lowy, and on this occasion for the second book on Frank Lowy, which is called Frank Lowy, A Second Life, which is not a revision of the first book, it's a brand new book. Now, Jill Margo is known to many of you, particularly for a column in the Australian Financial Review, but she's one of Australia's most respected journalists. Her work has won some 20 awards, including two Walkley Awards, and she writes for the Australian Financial Review and has published best-selling books in the fields of biography and health. And tonight, Jill is here to talk on her book, Frank Lowy, A Second Life. Jill Margo, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. It's okay. Thank you all for coming tonight. I never really imagined that I'd write a second book about Frank Lowy. And when I finished the first one in 1999, he was about to turn 70, which back then seemed a sort of reasonable age to retire. He never quite said that he would retire, but I know the literature of retirement says that some men, even ambitious, high-achieving men, just make a sudden decision to retire. So I never knew. I'll tell you a little story about retirement, actually. In my other life as a journalist in the Financial Review, I was reading once a comment that Rupert Murdoch made, and he said that he intended, it was probably a throwaway line, but he said that he intended to run News Corporation until he was 100. So I thought, that's interesting. I wonder whether it's possible. Let me explore it. So I phoned up a few geriatric physicians, and I said, look, is this possible? And most of them said, you know, possible but highly unlikely. I was about to give up on the idea of writing the column when I phoned one more. And he said something very interesting to me, something that's really stayed with me. He said, you know, if you look at Murdoch, let's look at Murdoch. So he's got enough resources to buy all the medical advice he needs, all the medical devices he needs, all the services he needs. That's a good start. He's healthy and engaged. That's good. And if you look at his parentage, his mother lived past 100 and she was cognitively intact. That's a good sign. His father died in his sort of mid to late 60s of a heart condition, which these days is managed quite well and quite differently. So all that augurs quite well. So, you know, if you look at all those factors, he probably could run News Corporation to 100. But, he said, there's one thing nobody can defend against, no matter what your resources, no matter what your intellect, no matter what your power. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, it's a philosophical change. He said, sometimes a change just comes upon men. They've been ambitious and thrusting and pushing and getting ever, ever higher, and suddenly they just, something inside them relaxes, their drive dissipates, and they know that, and they're content with the view from where they are. They're no longer thrusting to go higher. And I thought that was very interesting. And so I looked at Murdoch, and I saw there was no sign of him relaxing. And then I looked at Frank Lowy and I saw there was no sign of him relaxing either. So these two men, who are now both sort of approaching their mid-80s or in their mid-80s, I think they've missed the opportunity for their philosophical change. But I started watching, having finished the first biography when Frank was about to turn 70, I then watched him from a distance. And I saw that he went on to do so many new things, and he entered a kind of creative period of his life where he started doing things that were not commercially driven, but they were matters of the heart. And he did all these different activities. And as I watched, I thought to myself, well, I could write a new chapter about that, and I could tack it onto the first book. And so I watched and I kind of sketched out something. And then he did more, and then I had two chapters, and then I had three chapters. And so it went, until eventually there was too much to tack onto the same book, and eventually we got this, the second book. And this second book really just tracks his life from the age of 70 to 85. And it's extraordinary. You know, the world is changing. Our society is aging. We're all doing much better with old age than we used to do. So much so that you know, it's now almost a cliche, become almost a cliche that people say that 60 is the new 40. You know, we've all heard it and we all just discard it. But in fact, people are functional much, much longer. And there have always been people who have been creative and, you know, they've lived to great ages and been creative to great ages, but now it's a much more common phenomenon. And I think that Frank Lowe is a very good example of the class. He might look his age, but he certainly doesn't feel his age, and he doesn't behave his age, and he doesn't let perceptions about age restrict his activities. He kept going very strong between 70 and 85, until this year, he did have a little change. And I'll tell you what it was, and what initiated it, is that you probably all saw it was a very public incident. He went to Melbourne to give a trophy at a grand final, an A-League soccer grand final, and the stage was awkwardly designed, and he misstepped, and he fell off, and he fell quite spectacularly. He fell quite spectacularly, and it looked like he fell on his head, but actually he fell on his shoulder, and then his head followed. And it was interesting. I spoke to him about this fall, and he said that all he remembered was going forward to give the trophy, and then the next thing he knew was on the ground, and he was lying on the ground, and he looked dead. You know, he was just lying like this, and he was thinking, and he was thinking to himself, look, there's a huge audience here, there's great expectations in this auditorium. I can't spoil this victory for, it was Melbourne, the Melbourne had won, I can't spoil this event. And then he also remembered what his son David always says. And he says, above all, look good. So he, with the help of paramedics, he got himself up, and he got back on the stage, and then he became entirely amnesic. He shook hands, and he said a few words, and he gave the trophy, and he waved, but he had no memory of doing any of that. That was all on automatic. It was all just using his reserve and all his conditioning to do that. And what he does remember is turning around, going down the steps, and walking out of the stadium, and he said that at the tunnel, there was a little chair sitting at the entrance of the tunnel. And he said he looked at that chair, and never in his life had there been a more welcome sight. And you know, and he sat in that, and then he went to hospital. And a couple of days later, he saw for the first time he saw the YouTube clip of the fall, and he was absolutely shocked at what he saw. And he had a kind of epiphany, and he made a decision, and he said, you know, this was. I'm extremely lucky to survive, to have survive this, not only survive, but survive intact with all my limbs still working. And I think this is a sign to me to have less activity and more appreciation of what I've got. So it wasn't quite a philosophical change, but it was a change initiated by that kind of injury. Anyway, he went away he was told that he was in good health, and he went away for a couple of months, and then he'd had an accumulation of blood in his head from the place where he'd fallen, and he had to have that drained. He had a subdural hematoma. He had to have that drained, and that was potentially very, very dangerous. And he came back to Australia eventually, and he's been recovering from that ever since. But I'm very pleased to say that now he's much better, and quite well, and we'll be launching this book next week. So, you know, Frank Lowe is an interesting. Came to Australia, as most of you know. I think most of you probably know the sketch of his story, but some people call him Australia's most successful post-war immigrant. I'm not sure if he is, but he's probably one of them. And he arrived in this country with a small suitcase, and he was in debt. His family had borrowed money to pay for his fare across. But he was always upward bound and always ambitious, and his first job to repay this debt was in a basement in a tool factory. And he was really extremely miserable and depressed sitting in the basement doing mechanical work that he and watching the clock tick and having his little sandwich in a bag. And he aspired more than anything else to get a job above ground. And the next job he did, and somebody who could speak English and write English wrote a letter of application for him, and he got a job making sandwiches in an arcade. And he was thrilled with that, and today he sits in a high, he's way above ground. He sits on the 29th, 30th floor, just below Centre Point Tower. So he's moved up. But the interesting thing about him is that his aspirations for himself and to push himself forward is also very aspirational for Australia, for his adopted country. The other day at David Petraeus was here, that five-star general from America, and he called Frank Lowy a patriot, a kind of American term. And I thought to myself, well, that's right. He does so much for Australia. He kind of believes in Australia, and he's always trying to push Australia's image abroad and always trying to boost Australia. And he does this through his think tanks, the Lowy Institute for Foreign Policy. He does this through football. And he also did this through Westfield, through the building of Westfield and then making it an international business and taking Australian business abroad. So the interesting thing about him is, so here's a man who's created a legacy for himself. And one of the reasons that he's so successful is that he's always looking ahead. He always, I might plan a week ahead or perhaps a year ahead at a push. He's planning, he's always looking 10 years ahead, 20 years ahead. He's got an incredibly long horizon, longer than anybody else that I imagine. And people say of him that he would be, he could be a chess master because, he rolls out the far-reaching consequences of each move. And this is a pretty exhausting process. And when you start doing that, you kind of get into a loop and it becomes self-generating. And so consequently, he never rests. He's got no off button. He struggles to sleep. And there's always something going on in his head. His sons describe him as a man in perpetual motion. So when I talk about his legacy, I'll just mention a few things that I think some of the impact he's had on Australia. He's changed the way we shop. I mean, he didn't invent shopping centres, and he certainly didn't open the first shopping centre in Australia. But when they already existed. But he turned shopping into a kind of leisure activity, almost into entertainment. And town planners and social planners use a term called the Westfield effect, which doesn't only apply to Westfield, but that's just a shorthand. And it describes the phenomenon where people, for their recreation, will often choose to go to a mall rather than the beach or a natural attraction. One of the difficulties, I must say, of talking about Frank Lowy is wherever I go and talk about him, there's always people in the audience who know more about certain aspects of his life than I do. And I recognise two or three people in the audience tonight who do so. So he changed the way we shop. He turned shopping centres into sort of leisure destinations. He also changed the way we play football, which I'll come to later. He broadened interest in foreign policy and through the Lowy Institute. And what's hardly known, and what's in fact only become public in very recent time, is he had an enormous impact on retinal research. One day he was in 2003. 2003 was a very important year for him. He was about to turn 73. He was feeling in the prime of his life. And they'd had a weekend of celebrations in the family, and the family had come from abroad, and everybody was very happy and full of the joys of life and feeling blessed and feeling that this is as good as it gets. And Frank was sitting in his office on the Monday after this fabulous weekend of celebration, and his office door opened, and I'm just going to read you a little part from this book, and you'll understand the retinal research. So his office door opened and Stephen walked in. That's his youngest son. The pleasure from the weekend was absent from his face. He pulled up a chair. "Dad," he said, "the results are bad. I may be losing my vision. I could be legally blind in 5 years, maybe 10. As Stephen explained the rarity and the apparent incurability of his eye condition, His father listened in silence. When it was over, he made a solemn promise. "Stephen, we will find a way. We'll use our family and financial capacity to solve this issue." With that, he got up, walked around his desk, and put his arms around his youngest son. Frank would later describe this news as a tremendous shock, but his mind immediately went into overdrive. "In my mind, very quickly, I played out the scenario of us running around the world from doctor to doctor with no satisfactory resolution. I know of a lot of people chasing non-existent cures, and we were not going to take that route. At that moment, I knew what we would have to do. We had been heavily involved in medical research for many years, and now we would have to extend it. Stephen couldn't be alone in this. There must have been others with this condition who needed help too. With full belief, I promised Stephen and myself we'd do whatever was humanly possible to solve this." They then went on to spend many, many tens of millions of dollars getting the best in the world into a virtual institute and having, so that working virtually and meeting several times a year and exploring this extremely rare condition. They discovered through their research, and the more they discovered, so people came out of the woodwork and it moved from being rare to sort of uncommon. And then they made a kind of medical breakthrough, small breakthrough in understanding the disease. And this, and the work that they've done is absolutely galvanized. It's got all the attention of people in the ophthalmic community, and it's going to have it has implications for all sorts of retinal conditions. And this is a private exploration for Stephen and for public good. And so this will turn out to be a considerable loss because the condition overlaps with, it's similar to a diabetic condition. Another impact that Frank has made on society, is on Australia, is through his philanthropy. He at a philanthropy at Australia meeting about, I think it was last year or perhaps the year before, he was interviewed at the University of New South Wales, and this is the first time I've heard him put a figure on it. He said that in the decade just passed, he'd given $350 million in through philanthropy. But what's interesting about him is that he gives his time and his money. He always says that the easiest thing in the world is to write a check, but much more difficult to give time. And his time, particularly in his 80s, in his 70s and 80s, is very precious. And what I find interesting is I worked on a biography of James Wolfensohn too a few years ago. And he's an enormous philanthropist. He loves to give. It makes him high. It's like a drug. Just sort of, he gets completely, it's intoxicating to give. And I think that Frank also gives. It also makes him feel wonderful. And they all talk about the absolute joy of giving and how they feel that people, and they say that people who don't give don't know what they're missing. It's very interesting, their attitude to giving. And what's the origin of giving? You know, why would he be a philanthropist? And he says, apart from the fact that he's wealthy and there's some social obligation on him to give, but he says that it comes from his childhood. He grew up in extremely modest circumstances. He lived in a small little house where he shared a bed with his brothers, and water was drawn from the garden, from a pump in the garden initially. And at one point his father didn't have great commercial acumen, and the house was under threat and they couldn't meet the mortgage payments. No, the family was at risk of losing their house. And his uncles came from a nearby village where they ran a grocery store. They didn't have much themselves, but they brought a suitcase full of notes and they saved the house. And he understood, and there were many examples of this in his childhood, of the family helping each other and people in his little community helping each other. And the prior story of helping and of sharing and of giving happened in the ghetto in Budapest during the Holocaust. And there were many families staying in a 2 or 3 room apartment. I can't remember what he said, maybe 30 people in a 2 or 3 room apartment. Very little food, incredibly difficult situation. But he would forage for food and bring it home to his mother. And his brother, occasionally, who was in hiding, would bring a little basket of food to his mother. And this was very precious, this food. And he would bring the basket, and he would give it to his mother, and his mother would open the basket, and she would share the contents of the basket with everybody in the apartment. Against his protestations, he would say, "But save some for tomorrow. There may be no food tomorrow. We may be hungry tomorrow." And she would ignore him, and she would just share the food. And he said that those examples from his childhood and that sharing of the food stayed with him. And that's the origin of his life. People often ask me, what is life? And there are many people in this room who know very well what is life, but I'll tell you how. I'll give you some idea of what he's like when you meet him. He's kind of courteous in that European way. He observes etiquette. He's naturally polite, and he's socially considerate. He's also entirely present. It may not look like it, but he's listening intently. He's always, always on watch. It's part of his legacy from the Second World War days. And, for example, when he goes into a restaurant, he will book or he will go for the table in the corner. He'll sit in the corner with his back to the wall with a view to the door. Even in safe, boring Australia, where there's going to be no real threat to him, he will always sit watching the door. And he'll walk into a room and he'll be aware of what's happening in the room. It's this kind of inbuilt vigilance, and it comes from the time when he was living in hiding on the streets of occupied Budapest, and he was always at risk of death. And vigilance was absolutely necessary to stay alive. So when you meet him, he might not look vigilant, but he's actually completely aware of what's going on around him, acutely aware. He can be unreachable personally. He can be cold, just as he can be warm and embracing. What I find, what I like most about him is that he's open to change. He can make a definite stand on something. He can say, "This is the way it is, or this is the way it should be," and then he can change. And I find that admirable. He loves to hear a contrary view, and he has this concept called loyal opposition. So what's loyal opposition? It allows all views to be heard, even those directly opposed to the leader, on the understanding that nothing will be held against the individual who's expressing those views. So he surrounds himself with a very tight small group. He works with a small group of executives, and they can express a contrary view. In fact, he welcomes a contrary view. He doesn't want people to agree with him. He's genuinely curious person. I'll tell you a little story. Is that once he was on holiday with, he had a new friend on holiday with him who was a doctor, and they were making conversation, and this guy knows about stem cells, and he was talking. And so Frank was asking him about stem cells, and the doctor thought that he was just making polite conversation, but actually he was genuinely curious, and he asked for references. I mean, the doctor realized he was actually serious. His curiosity was serious when he asked for references. He finished school at 13. He's largely self-taught. 13 because he was. He was at school in Budapest in 1944, at age 13, and that's when Budapest was occupied, and that's when he ended school. But he's a kind of autodidact. He's very interested in politics, he reads biography, and he's taught himself most of the things that he knows. He's also got an unusual ability to ask basic questions. And when he was in the Reserve Bank of Australia for he was known for the art of asking basic questions. So they'd be discussing macroeconomics and economics and stuff, and he would say, "But hang on a second, what does that mean?" Or and there would be a sense in the room of relief to some extent, in that everything was brought back to first principles, and you could rediscuss it with fresh interest. He's also he's a kind of man without pretension. There's nothing pretentious about him. And he's got the capacity to see the big picture while paying full attention to the detail. I'm going to give you a little example of this point. So he had this advisor called Mark Beeler, who had been the head of HR for BT, the BT Bank. So Mark Beeler was in bed in New York when his phone rang. The caller was Frank Lowy. Beeler, an advisor to Westfield and the Lowy family, was used to receiving calls at odd hours, but now it was past 11 p.m., and Beeler was slightly annoyed. He listened to Frank and formed the view that the problem could have waited for daylight. Because of their relationship, he wouldn't disclose his irritation at the timing, but he did say, "You know, Frank, I would have thought at the point where I was worth $6 billion, I wouldn't be bothered by such insignificant things." Without missing a beat, Frank shot back, "You might stop to think that it's only people who are bothered by such insignificant things that make $6 billion." He always says, and I could never quite follow it, he said, no one detail is more important than another. All the details matter. I mean, it's an exhausting way to live. All the details matter. Has he changed since the first book? The first time I wrote a book, he wasn't so well known then, and most of what was known about him was carefully controlled by the Westfield machine. And he was very interested in the first book, and he was interested in the details of the first book, and he would often ask me, you know, how's it going, what's happening. The second book, he was less interested. The first book is a kind of typical rags to riches type book. You know, it goes from naught to 70, came here with nothing, you know, landed up, built an empire, and so rags to riches, classic tale. This new book is then what? What do you do when you 70 years old and you've got your empire, what next? And he was kind of, he was more philosophical, and he was prepared to step, you know, he was interested in the book, and he talked to me a lot for many, many hours, and he gave me access to the family. But this is a much more serious book. It's got different issues. It hasn't got the dramatic narrative of the early life. But it's a more interesting book, in my view, and it's more revealing. He was willing this time The first time I wrote the book, he was quite guarded, and he showed me a little bit about what he thought and a little bit of the family. But this time, he kind of really opened up, and the book is rich in revelation. Also, it tells you a lot about the family and the family structure and the machinery of family and how they run their own little family machine. Because of his Holocaust history and all that was lost during that period, keeping the family intact is absolutely paramount for him. You know, it's family over alles. It's just the family is. And when you ask him what his greatest achievement is in his life, he says keeping his family together. He kept his nuclear family together and very tight central control. And, you know, unity requires a lot of discipline. So, for example, it would be mandatory for his children to be home on Friday nights, the Sabbath. They might have social engagements, they might have school engagements, they might have sporting engagements, they might not want to be there at all, but it was not negotiable. They had to be there. And it's interesting the function of having this obligatory a family gathering once a week, because anybody who's got complaints or irritations or arguments, you kind of come around a table, you sit opposite each other, and there's a resolution. And every week you come together and it's a reassertion of family unity and some resolution to anything that might have happened during the week. He was a very strict disciplinarian with his sons. He always backed up his wife, and he would come home from work looking forward to seeing his sons in the evening, and his wife would say they'd behave terribly, they need to be disciplined. And he wouldn't have the heart for it, but he was important for him in that traditional family way, with his traditional family model, to discipline his sons, and he would do it. And unlike today, where children negotiate with their parents, you know, I'll do this if you do that, and maybe three, and next door does differently. In that traditional family model, there was no negotiation at all. It was a rigid, rigid structure. But that strong, you know, people look back on that, some people look back on that with bewilderment, some people look back on that with envy. But it's I think that it's a kind of, it's a model that's no longer employed today. But that strong central control was loosened with the generations. But however, it's still very strong with him and his sons and the immediate family. But it requires a lot of maintenance, and they spend an enormous amount of time, him and his sons, attending to the structure of the family. I've got in the book there's a whole chapter about the machinery of the family and how you keep this kind of family with all these diverse interests and with all these assets, how you keep them together. I'll read you a small piece that he told me about the mechanics. Each of the family, there's him and he's got three sons, so they're four Lowy men, and each family within the clan is unique in a kind of silo, but the four men are tightly bound together. And I'll read you just a small piece from it. So he says, each family is unique with its own characteristics, outlook, social life, and friends. There's no regular social contact between the families. Friday nights used to be mandatory, but now it's all much looser. While the women look after the welfare of their own families and have their own work and outside interests, they have no role in the business and are not involved in the family's finances at all. The four men take care of the larger family, the larger unit. It's very male, but the relationship between us is strong. Compromises are made all the time to keep this relationship intact. Nothing interferes with it. Financially, we are all locked in. We have common interests, and any of the four of us can have what we want, what we need. It all balances out over time. There are no financial issues between us. While the model works well, it's not as sweet as it appears to be, and everyone makes concessions. There are tensions and differences of opinion, but these don't last. Everyone finds their place. We strive to keep the unity above all else. So it's interesting because the conscious working, the constant, continual working at keeping this family together. He said that I expect that my sons offload their frustration about me to one another. Of course, they have their disapprovals about each other too, and in a way, I'm the sponge. I absorb the disapprovals from one to the other. The test will be what happens when I'm gone. I wanted to talk to you about. So he's had this tight control, and in business he's very autocratic, and he's been a powerful driver of Westfield for a long time. But he grooms his sons to come into the business, and he grooms them to be ambitious, and he grooms them to be outspoken. And so there he is at the top of the mountain, running the place, and he looks down and he sees his three sons coming up with the same ambitions that he once had. And the book deals with the complexities of sharing power and how it happens and how everybody has to adjust. And they make a successful fist of it. And it's interesting to see, not without quite a lot of shouting and quite a lot of sort of conflict. And what happened later in Westfield, and I'll just sort of go fast now, is that his sons have driven radical change through the business. And change that he initially resisted, but they kind of persuaded him that was a good idea. So maybe in the Q&A I can talk about business and football and the issues that I haven't covered so far.
Many thanks, Jill. Once again, thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this fine facility this evening. Janet Grundy's got copies of Frank Lowy, A Second Life by Jill Margot, and I'm sure Jill will be happy to sign them after the talk. So we come to questions and discussion, and we've got to the top of the hour, so we have a lot of time. I've just bought your book, and I've just started it. Interesting comments by Tom Keneally up the front. But tell us about the, as I recall, most apart from the fall of the soccer match of Frank Lowy, what I recall most vividly in the last 10 years since the first book would be the Australian story on ABC TV about how Frank Lowy discovered the fate of his father, which, and there seems to be a degree of recovered memory in this most interesting tale, which then went on to the occasion of the ceremony or remembrance at the camp in Europe. So tell us about how that came about.
So Frank was 13 in occupied Budapest when, in March 19, the Nazis occupied the city, and his father disappeared the next day. And the family never knew what happened to him. And he lived with this huge loss, spent the next 50 years looking for his father, didn't know where he was. And he was left with, he didn't really know his father, because although it was when they lived in the countryside before they moved to Budapest, his father was a commercial traveller, was away all week, and then he came home on the weekends, didn't have much time with his father. And he would ask people, what was my father like? And they'd say, oh, he was an avuncular man, he was well-loved, he was so adept, but he didn't have much commercial acumen. And this is what stayed with Frank, he didn't have much commercial acumen. He was okay, but he didn't have much. And so it was a kind of incomplete picture, but because of all the, so many people had died during the Holocaust, there were very few people to ask about, to get a deeper picture of his father. And he lived with this notion of his father. And then about in the 1990s, through absolute coincidence, the most extraordinary story of coincidence, one of his sons discovered what happened to Frank's father. One of his sons discovered what happened to his grandfather. And they followed that through, and they began to learn things about him that they never knew. First of all, he was taken from a railway station in Budapest and put in a holding camp by the Germans, by the Nazis. And in that camp, he emerged as the leader of the men, the leader of the Bar of 200 men. He was a very pious and devout man, and he led them in prayer, and he kept them spiritually uplifted, and he kept them optimistic, and he kept them hopeful. And he became their leader. And he would pray psalms with them every day. And then they were put on the train to Auschwitz, and they got to Birkenau. Birkenau is the death camp in Auschwitz, of Auschwitz. They got to Birkenau, and he was carrying a small bag, a prayer bag, with some prayer items in it, some Jewish religious items in it. And he'd used these items during the holding camp to lead these men in prayer. And he got on. They were taken to Birkenau in a train, no food, no water, days on end, cramped, absolutely cramped like herrings, like sardines in these wagons. They get off the train. And there's guards everywhere. There's SS everywhere. There's Germans everywhere. And they're dazed. They're dehydrated. They're exhausted. And he's holding his little bag. And they're told to put their luggage down. And they'll get it later. He doesn't trust them. So he's holding onto his little bag. A guard comes along, takes his bag, throws it down. When the guard turns his back, Frank's father goes and he retrieves the bag. This happens once or twice, another couple of times. All the while, the people that he'd been leading in prayer are watching, standing around watching, and they know what's in the bag. They know it's not jewels, he's not hiding anything, they know it's just religious items. And his father was so intent on not surrendering his faith and keeping his religious items that he went back for the bag again. And this time the guards had their rifles and they beat him to death with their rifles, there and then. And so Frank got to understand when he was 80 years, when he was approaching his 80, you know, in his late 70s and 80s, that his father actually had, there was a whole other dimension to this man. He wasn't just the man with little commercial acumen who was sort of socially, you know, accomplished. He had this whole other side. You know, he was a leader, a spiritual leader of men. He had a spiritual dimension. He had personal power. And suddenly, at the age of 80, there he was, feeling proud of his father. You know, he'd found out the stuff about his father. And then he had an overwhelming desire. Well, he'd always had an overwhelming desire to bury his father. Everybody who... When somebody dies, you want to leave a mark. You want to leave a little plaque, a stone. You want to do something to mark where a person has died. But because he died in Birkenau, the greatest Jewish graveyard in the world, and because his body went up in smoke, There was no records. You know, how do you go into Birkenau, which is a vast empty space, and put a plaque? People go every day, and they put down little plaques or they put down little memorials here and there, and the authorities of Birkenau understand this, and they leave them for a couple of weeks, and then they clear them up and take them away. Otherwise, the place would be littered because there were so many millions died, and so many people come. And Frank really had this idea that he couldn't rest until he'd find a place to bury his father. This became something very urgent and very important for him. And he managed to discover where his father had died, because what happened is that towards the end of 1944, the Germans were rushing the Hungarian Jews to their death. And it was up until that date they dropped, up until about May, they dropped all the Jews outside the camp and had them, the healthy people could walk in and the infirm were trucked in. But that was too inefficient for killing. They couldn't kill enough every day. So they devised this idea of taking the railway line right into the camp, close to the gas chambers, so it could all become efficient. And they were so efficient that sometimes they were killing 12,000 people. And so they figured out that this is where Frank's father had died. He died at the ramp of this new railway line. So now Frank had a location. What could he do with that? So he looked around and he thought, well, what about putting a wagon that was used, an authentic wagon used, to transport Hungarian Jews to Birkenau? What about getting one of those wagons and putting it there, and so he'd have a place and there'd be a memorial for the 500,000 Hungarian Jews who died in Birkenau, and for his, one of whom was his father. The problem he faced was that the Birkenau had this notion that you couldn't add anything to the site. They wanted to keep it as empty as it had been at the time of 1945. But as it happened, a new director came of the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex, and he said, "We can. It would be educational. It would keep interest if we could have an original wagon there, because people would come and they would see it. They'd be able to touch it. They would understand the size, the proportion. They'd get a real feeling for it." So Frank thought about that for a long time, and then he decided, "Okay, we'll try and find a wagon." And you would think that it wouldn't be a difficult thing to do. Because actually, until 1970, wagons that were used to transport Jews in 1944 were still in use. Any day of the week until the 1970s, you could look across the skyline in sort of Germany and Hungary, and you could see wagons, you know, carrying their cargo up and down the countryside. And those were exactly the wagons that were used to transport Jews, because they used to go back to a central depot, get hosed out, and then be used the next day for horses or for mail or for hay or whatever it was. Anyway, they hunted for a wagon for three years, and eventually they found one. And they took this wagon back to Birkenau. Those tracks hadn't been used, you know, I don't know what, for 50, 60 years. And they wheeled, they pushed this wagon in, and they put a plaque on it saying, you know, as a memorial for the 500,000 Hungarian Jews who died here in the spring and summer of 1944. And then Frank wanted to put somewhere, unobtrusively, a little plaque saying the wagon was dedicated by the family of Hugo Lowy, who was one of those and died there. But they said, "There's no evidence that he. Where's the evidence? We can't put it in. You know, you're saying that we have to have. There has to be some evidence. We have to have proof that this happened. So how? Where are you going to find proof? It's now sort of 2009. Where are you going to find proof?" So there was one witness, which is how the son found out the story. And this witness was on his deathbed in New York. So they phoned him up, and he was really terribly, terribly sick. And he told his story, and the line was crackly, and he didn't tell it well, and his English wasn't fantastic, and he's got a heavy accent. And he told the story, and then he knew what was at stake. And he couldn't rest. And at the end of they put the phone down, and then he told his wife and his son, "You know, I've got to give this testimony. I've got to give it. And they managed to recontact the Birkenau Museum people. And he, with his last energy, he gave testament. He gave 2 hours of testament with his wife helping him on the phone, telling the story of Hugo Lowy, who was Frank's father, and verifying it. And that through that testament, at the last moment he died a short while later, who was able to put a small plaque at the back of the wagon. And now he has, for himself and for his family, he has, it's not exactly a headstone or a grave, but it's a place. He knows where his father died, and he knows that that's the place. And then the final twist is that, so his father died because of the prayer bag. And when they went to do a commemoration service on the wagon, he had his own prayer bag with him, because the men prayed in the morning. And he looked at this prayer bag, and there was somebody came up with the idea of putting his prayer bag inside the wagon to symbolically replace the prayer bag torn from his father. And he did it. And today, if you go to Birkenau, as you come in, you look straight down the railway line, you see a wagon that looks like it's been there always. And the wagon is sealed. Inside, everybody knows, there's a little legend, that there's this blue prayer bag. And that was the resolution for him. He finally managed to bury his father.
Thank you. Ida, come back here.
Thank you very much, Jill. You talked about Frank Lowy's male-dominated business. Could you share with us something about the role and the influence of women in his life, particularly his wife?
There's a question about Frank Lowy's male-dominated business and a question about the role of women in his life, in particular his wife.
Okay. I think that the two women who are absolutely central to his life, and with his mother and his wife, he was immensely close to his mother. And just to go back to Budapest in 1944, when the father went missing and the family split up for safety, some had false papers. He didn't have papers, and he went into hiding with his mother. And for that whole period of the Holocaust, he lived with his mother. They shared a bed. They were emotionally bound. He kept her alive because he was resourceful with finding food and keeping them safe. She kept him alive with love and attachment. And he said, and he still, he would say for years, wherever my mother is, that's home. And so his mother was central in that way. And he has a spiritual idea that his mother is still with him. So, you know, apart from the politics and the feminism and male domination and all that, his mother is absolutely infused within him. His wife is the other highly significant person in his life. She chose to, or they chose to have a traditional family structure, as was the case when they got married in the 50s. She stayed home. She ran the place. He was away a lot. He travelled a lot. And she, in fact, her son, at one of their celebrations, one of the sons is a musician, and he wrote a song for her. And the refrain of the song is, "You were always there." And so she is deeply bound to them, and she and he says that she is the foundation on which his career and his success is built. A lot of feminists and a lot of people say, well, she didn't have a career of her own, she didn't have a life outside of the family, but she says, and with honesty and sincerity, that was what she wanted. She wanted that sort of a life. She wanted to devote herself to her life partner and to her children and to building a family. Later in life, she went to university and did a degree, and she started a charitable organization.
Right, so question here? Yeah.
Yep. To a lot of Jewish people I know, just Jewish atheists, and one of them explained to me one time that, well, if you went through World War II, would you think there's someone up there protecting you? And I'm just wondering, does Frank fall into this camp? Is he sort of religious also, as well as being Jewish identity?
The question is Frank Lowy an atheist Jew, or is he a religious Jew?
I think he would describe himself as a traditional Jew. You know, I think that he goes to the synagogue on high holy days. He goes some Sabbaths. I think that he identifies entirely as a Jew, in community-wise, and culturally so. But you know, he's also, and I understand. I know the whole dilemma of people who went through the Holocaust and where was God, and how could this happen? He has faith. His father was, you know, I described the faith that his father had in that holding camp before they got to Birkenau. And even at Birkenau, he had this faith. And actually, his father at Birkenau, I'll tell you this, is that when they had the dedication ceremony, one of the former chief Ashkenazi rabbi of Israel came to officiate. And he, Jews don't really have martyrs, but they have another term. And he gave Hugo Lowy that term. It was really something quite extraordinary.
Yes.
Jill, the old saying used to be that the first generation built the business, the second generation maintained it, and the third generation lost it. Is there any evidence of the third generation coming through into the...
Well, he always, so they say repeatedly, the family, that they're not building a House of Lowy and they've got no dynastic aspirations. So the second generation all went in, all three sons went into Westfield, all were executives, all three sons were on the board members before they were 30, which was quite extraordinary. But then he did have a penchant for having young people on the board. David Gonski and others were on the board too before they were 30, when they were young. The third generation, none of them are being encouraged to come and go into the business. Some of them are peripherally in the business, and some of them, one of them is working with IT in the business, in the whole trying to, in the ushering in of the digital age into shopping. But I can't really say much about the third generation. They're still growing up.
Question here? Yes.
How will the A-League go without Frank Lowy?
The A-League?
Yeah.
How will the A-League and soccer go without Frank Lowy?
Well, I think that what he's done is, you know, he came into football in 2003, and the game was... John Howard asked him to... There'd been an inquiry, and John Howard asked him if he'd take charge of football and rebuild it. And at the time, football was really ethnically riven. Every weekend was... There was either a replay of World War II, the old sort of ethnic rivals, or there was a sort of projected, you know, World War III. And people used to throw projectiles, and some matches, the announcements were in foreign languages, and there was so much fighting and so much chaos that some of the average Aussies wouldn't go. The existing average Australian population wouldn't go. So what Frank wanted to do, and what many reformers before him wanted to do, was to de-ethnicise football and make it a mainstream sport. And this is what the new A-League does, de-ethnicises. I think that his aim was not to make himself indispensable. To make himself dispensable. He wanted to make himself dispensable. He wanted to create a professional structure that the sport would be professionalised, would be mainstream, and would be able to run ahead when his term ended with professional management. And I think the A-League will survive without it very well. And, talking about football, he really did change it. He had tremendous successes, and, of course, he had his biggest failure of his career in... his inability to bring home the World Cup and the whole disaster that followed from that.
And the other failure he would regard of his career, I think, would be the unsuccessful venture with Channel 10. So what would have driven a sharp guy like Frank Lowy into a business like Channel 10?
Okay, it was the market was booming. he was confident, he was full of confidence. He thought it was time to diversify. All his eggs were sort of in one basket, and he thought. And media stocks were the fashion of the day. Everybody was going to media, and so he went into media too, and without success.
I think we've got the final question down there. Yeah.
The subject of a lot of Frank was to start Westfield today. Would it be easier or harder?
So the subject came up. Would it be harder or easier, in Frank Lowy's view, to start Westfield today?
All I can say is I've never asked. I don't know.
There's a question here. Yeah.
Just interested, Jill, in the process as a biographer. How much time did you actually spend with the family, with Frank? Did you schedule in interviews with them, or did you sort of do it by osmosis by being a part of the family? Like, what was that process like?
No, I'm not part of the family. I would make appointments. I would say, can I come? I would say, I want to talk about whatever, and can I come and see you for an hour? And I'd take a tape recorder, and I'd spend hours and hours and hours transcribing tapes. And I quite like that, because you hear it the first time, and then you hear it again, and you transcribe selectively. So I've made, it was all done, it was all sort of And then I'd have interviews. I'd ask for interviews with the sons and with other people. And sometimes I'd have to come back and say, well, you know, he says X, you say Y, you know, where's the truth? And sometimes we would argue. And but we spent a lot of time across the table.
So what's next in line? You've done Lowy 1, Lowy 2, you've done others. Is there a Lowy 3, do you think?
No, I don't think so. No Lowy 3, I don't think. What's next in line is another men's health book.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, half the audience here will read it. Yeah. Many thanks, Jill. Janet Grinder's got copies of Frank Lowy, A Second Life. I and Anne here and others used to be great admirers of Frank Lowy. He's had an enormous contribution to Australia. So I think it's befitting not only that there was a first book on Frank Lowy, but he's had such an active second half of his life that it's appropriate that there is a second book on Frank Lowy. And I'm not too sure there won't be a third book on Frank Lowy, but we will see. But for tonight, many thanks for coming along to tell us this fascinating story about a fascinating Australian and his family and his business and his various interests. Well done, and thanks again. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.